You're listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on the 10th of May, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is The Big Interview, our one-on-one programme where people with extraordinary lives, powerful careers and maybe tall tales sit down to tell us what really happened, how they got here and what makes them tick. Today I'm talking to Matthew Slotover, co-founder with Amanda Sharp of Frieze magazine in 1991 and the Frieze Art Fair, now Fairs, in 2003. Any profile of Slotover uses the phrase art world power player, and who are we to disagree? What an interesting world contemporary art is, where talent, talk and money meet in that most vibrant of ways. And Matthew Slotover has been at the heart of it for more than two decades. Born in 1968 in London, Matthew is a St. Paul's and Oxford graduate, but where did the love of art come from? This edition of The Big Interview will find out. Matthew, welcome to the programme. We're going to cast our minds back to 1991, that first issue of Frieze. I think I'm right in saying it was the first sort of big magazine interview with Damien Hirst. It was right at the sort of crest of a wave, and you and Amanda were kind of, I guess, two of the head surfers on it. What was that beach like? I mean, that's sort of an amazing apocryphal time of change, a time of when, when British art especially was sort of in the ascendancy. What was the atmosphere like? Did it feel like you were part of something special?
It did, actually. You could feel it in the air. It was amazing. I've never really experienced that before or since.
Yeah.
You know, we graduated in 89, which is probably the worst part of the recession, which for getting a job as a graduate is probably a worse time than the last recession. And I had a degree in psychology, you know, completely useless, and didn't know what I wanted to do, and just began to look at art with a friend at art school and met some of these artists and started seeing what they were doing. And it just spoke to me immediately. I just thought it was so exciting. I thought they were exciting. And every week there would be something new happening and another amazing exhibition in a godforsaken part of London, and that was beautiful and that was attracting attention, gradually more and more attention from London and then beyond. And you could sense that there was a kind of acceleration of interest almost on a weekly basis, yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, that, and I presume it was a network of people as well. Everybody was sort of living in each other's pockets, going out with each other, working with each other. There was a lot of shared DNA around at that point, I guess, in
tiny.
The art world.
It was tiny. I mean, there were basically probably five or six international commercial galleries in London at that time, and now there must be over 100. And, you know, every week there'd be one or two openings. And you would go to an opening, go to the pub after the opening, and it made the same 40, 50 people. That was it. That was the art world in London. So everyone knew each other quite quickly and knew what each other were doing and would kind of comment and be excited by what each other were doing. So it was very kind of intense.
Back then in the early 90s, did it feel like a club you belonged to? Did it feel like sort of one endless party? I mean, that's it's so well documented. I mean, you know, this is the era when every taxi driver knew the name of two of the most famous contemporary artists in the world. Yeah. I mean, that was...
This is the era before that.
This is the era kind of slightly before that.
The start of that,
But was it cooperative or was it competitive?
No, it was only gently competitive, I'd say. I mean, you've got to remember, before that period, before the early 90s, London was a backwater for contemporary art. There was no Tate Modern. Tate Britain might do an international contemporary show once every 5 years. There was the ICA, there was the Serpentine. Chisenhill was doing interesting things then. But globally, London was nowhere really on the map. Cologne was very important there, New York, obviously. And, you know, there were individual galleries like the Listen Gallery or Anthony Doffe that had been going since the late 60s, early 70s. But that was really it. And they might take on one artist every couple of years. So there was no opportunities for artists at all, really. You know, there might be literally one artist a year who could come out of college and get a gallery.
And I guess it was a DIY aesthetic to much of that work. I mean, installation pieces as opposed to painting, which was sort of out, seemed to be out of favour, or at least looking back, it seemed to be out of favour at the time. So people were sort of making their own way. It was kind of not punk in the sense of Mohicans and Studs, but there was a punk aesthetic in the sense of make it yourself, Tracy Emin and Sarah Lucas having a shop, working together, making almost anything to sell.
Yeah, there was a variety of media. You know, I wouldn't, I mean, you know, when Damien Hirst was making his cabinets, they were extremely slickly made with producers, you know, so it wasn't all DIY. And there were painters too. Ian Davenport, Fiona Ray were amongst the first of those artists, Gary Hume, to kind of get some international recognition. So it was quite broad, actually. But there was definitely a sense that we have to do it ourselves. There is no structure here to support us. And so, yeah, a lot of the shows that people talk about now that were very influential were artist-organized shows. They were not in conventional museums or galleries.
I mean, you graduated a year after the freeze with three E's, not with the I.
Yeah.
Damien Hirst, sort of now very famous, sort of art historically important show, I suppose, which he curated, and it was his mates and his fellow students, I guess, at the time. You graduated the year after that. Was there one show that you saw that really made you go, right, here we go, let's try and do something, let's try and professionalise my interest in this?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see Freeze. It was before I got involved, but I saw Modern Medicine, which was the kind of almost the continuation in a warehouse in Rotherhithe called Building One. And there were a couple more shows there, Gambler and Michael Landy's Market. And they were incredible. You know, I can still remember the feeling going in, completely empty, pristine warehouses with the most incredible art. That was it. Seeing Modern Medicine and then meeting Damien and Carl and Billy, who were running it, you know, was an incredible moment for me.
And editorialising that then. How did that decision come? We mentioned Amanda Sharp in the introduction. When did you two meet? Were you kind of like the... There's a bit of Lennon and McCartney going on here.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, how did you two come together? Where did that relationship start?
Yeah. So Amanda, I met at the university and we were really good friends there. She was interested in media. She worked a little bit for a company called The Power Station, which was kind of MTV competitor. And they actually went bust, I think, in 1990. I'd been involved in magazines a bit. I think design, architecture magazines had always been my interest kind of growing up, and music, less so art. And then when I got obsessed with art, I started reading the magazines to find out what's this stuff all about, you know. And I didn't like the magazines. I thought they were badly designed and badly written, and they weren't talking about the art that I thought was interesting. They'd become quite stiff, I suppose, and I'd grown up with the Face and ID, and I thought magazines could be really exciting and could, you know, encapsulate this younger generation that was coming up, not just in Britain, but internationally. And so together with Amanda and Tom, who was actually the third partner and editor for the first 10 years, who left after about 10 years to be an artist, we started the magazine. We all kind of did everything, although Tom was trained as a designer and is a fantastic designer, is now a great artist, and he's written books and made films, and he's kind of visual, although a good writer too. Amanda's a bit more outgoing than me, so she was a bit more on the publishing side, and I was a bit more on the kind of organizational editorial side. But we just listed ourselves as all editors because we were in a room, you know, the size of this, and just doing everything.
That's this from these sort of like not enough room to swing a cat kind of editorial cupboards that, you know, there's tiny acorns from which mighty oaks grow. We'll go on to what those mighty oaks have become. You know, fairs in London and New York and you know, such a breadth of stuff that's under that sort of Freeze umbrella. It was something that we experienced at Monocle 9 years ago, that great joy when you rip open the cardboard boxes with the first issues in. What was the feeling there? I mean, it's a rare and wonderful thing to be able to crystallise what you think about a moment in paper with adverts in it, with a nice back page. What was the vibe and the party like on the launch of the first issue of Freeze?
We did do a party, and we kind of squatted
and
someone else's party.
And it gets cloudy. Okay.
There was a place in South Kensington, I remember, called The Collection.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's called now, but
that,
it's got
that long
alleyway.
Walkway.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was about 3 weeks before we launched, and we thought maybe we should do a party, I think. And we kind of knew that space, and there happened to be a very complex exhibition of kind of Japanese light installation or something. I've no idea, I can't remember what it was, but it was very dramatic, someone else's thing completely. And I think we said, can we do a party here or something? And they said yes. And so we did it. And I remember we had a quote from Richard Prince on the invitation, which was from one of his joke paintings. And Damien's on the cover of our pilot issue, and Richard Prince is on the cover of issue number one. And the quote was, what does it mean when you come into a house and there's love and there's fun and there's, you know, appeal? It means you're in the wrong house. That's what it means, you know. And so it's kind of a nice kind of moment. That was the launch party. But actually the pilot issue, it came out the same day as the Royal College Degree Show. And in fact, it was my first date with my wife, current wife, well, was that day.
The sort of Royal Mint can do a commemorative coin for you.
That's right. She was working at the V&A, and we were trying to think of somewhere to go. And I said, well, I'm going to the Royal College Degree Show. And she said, oh, I'm going
with
to go
with the null number of Freeze under
your arm.
Yeah, and
I had like 15 copies of this magazine. And it was the year Gavin Turk graduated. And It was an interesting year, actually, where he had the plaque
yeah.
and he was kicked out. He didn't get his degree because the teachers thought he was just taking the piss, but it turned out to be the most interesting yeah, right. artist of the generation, yeah. of course. But it was a good year, and I just walked around handing out this magazine, and everyone was incredibly complimentary and said, this is great, this is what we need, you know. And we'd been working reasonably quietly at it for 9 months or so. And yeah, it was a good evening.
And I wonder whether you said, you know, at that point you'd reading, there was this sort of nascent British art scene with these recently graduated or not even graduated people that were not becoming stars, but becoming certainly well known and certainly in an area of the city. Mm-hmm. I wonder what it was, what you brought to it from a sort of non-art background. You know, whether you said you liked reading The Face, you liked ID, you liked music magazines, that was more your vibe, and architecture magazines, I suppose. Did that sort of help to talk about art in a not a stiff, not a reactionary way?
Yeah, I mean, that was always the aim, to present it in a clear way, both design-wise and in terms of the text. We just wanted a clean contemporary design, which the other magazines hadn't really caught up with. And we wanted language that people would understand. And I thought, oh, they're so badly written, the art magazines. But then, you know, editing them for a while, you realise it's difficult to write about art and to write about art in a clear, accessible way while not, you know, reducing the level of criticism and while having the highest level of kind of knowledge and understanding. It's tricky. I mean, art's not a verbal medium. You know, if you're writing about theatre or music or interviewing people or books, you know, there are words kind of engaged with it. With art, you've got something that is totally non-verbal and you've got to find the words to put to it.
We're going to sort of hit the hyperdrive button in a minute. We're going to zoom forward towards the foundation of the first fair. You mentioned that there weren't really any collectors in London in the early 90s. I suppose the shark circling shallow water was Charles Saatchi at that time, buying a lot of stuff and lots of sort of almost easy pickings, you might say.
Yeah.
But obviously taking a risk and making people's reputations, Damien Hirst, sort of most famously, I suppose, in the beginning.
Yeah.
What was that like? I mean, that sort of makes the young British artists, I wonder if you felt that they were grouped together almost by dint of being bought by Saatchi in that era. Mm. Did that make it a movement, or did you think it was just a collection of people that were working in a particular era?
Yeah, so there's many ways of answering this, and it's a fascinating
It's a $64 million question.
Yeah, so one question is about Charles Saatchi and his influence. And clearly, you know, I remember when we did the first interview with Damien, in the interview he says, I want to get a shark and I want to put it in a tank and it's going to be called this. And it was before he'd done it and we thought, wow.
Did it keep the same name, the physical impossibility of death?
Yeah, he had the title right at the beginning.
Good lad.
And we thought, good luck to you. You know, that sounds fantastic. But he took the interview to Charles Saatchi and Charles Saatchi said, how much money do you need? And he said, well, it's going to cost £8,000 to make and to buy it will be whatever. And Charles said, okay, here's the money. Go to Australia, get the shark, bring it back. I'll fund the production. And he actually funded the production. And if it hadn't been for him, maybe that work would never have been made. And that's a seminal work of British art. So, you know, all credit to him for that. You know, he bought Rachel Whiteread's Ghost, which was another absolutely key piece for something like £5,000 from Hitchens and the Hill Show. And there wasn't really anyone else around who wanted to do that. There wasn't huge competition for him. The artists were grateful to have someone allow them to make things and to buy things. So he was important. I think there are probably 50% of the artists from that era were not collected by Charles Saatchi. He wasn't interested in them. You won't find them in Sensation. Important artists like Douglas Gordon, for example, many others who just weren't to his taste, didn't like them, whatever reason. So you could do extremely well without being part of the Saatchi collection. It wasn't everything to be in as part of the collection. But, you know, for some people, you know, they may have done brilliantly without him, but there's certainly, you know, some examples of the work like The Shark that may not have been made at all without him.
We kicked off talking about Charles Saatchi and that there were very few collectors in London then at that point. I mean, the next thing we're going to talk about is setting up the Frieze Art Fair. The first fair was in 2003. Presumably in that intervening period you'd met some collectors. This thing seemed to be viable. It grew from being a magazine that you launched 12 years before, 11 years before. And suddenly that became a brand, and obviously your connections and your network became strong enough to decide to pitch a tent in Regent's Park. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
What kind of harebrained scheme was that?
Yeah, I mean, it was very instinctive. You know, we didn't set a research company out there to see if there was room in the market for it, you know. We hadn't actually met any collectors, really. We knew the galleries very well, though, and they were our main clients, still are, for the fair. And when Tate Modern opened in 2000, Gagosian and a couple of other galleries like Sprout and Hauser & Wirth had opened around that time. So there was some international
It's about galleries coming from Switzerland and Germany.
Yeah, and you felt, okay, if they're coming here, there must be a reason. And I put it down to the opening up of the City of London, the kind of modernisation of the UK under Tony Blair, and international people coming to the city, bringing their tastes with them, their taste in restaurants and interiors, but also their taste in art. Many collectors in London are one of the couple, maybe will be, not British. Mm. You'll find, in fact, many people in London you meet, that's the case too. But it was that kind of internationalization that allowed it to happen, I think. But really, our market research was going to the galleries and saying, if we did a fair in London, would you come? And Amanda was living in New York from 2000, and the New Yorkers said, yeah, great, we'd love to do a fair in London. Some of the British galleries actually were a bit slower and thought, I don't know if anyone will come. London's still a bit of a backwater. It still had that feeling to it, amazingly. I mean, only 12 years ago now, or 15 years ago. But we knew if the Americans and the Europeans were coming, then the British would come too.
And it's tough to actually imagine a pre-Frieze art fair, London art world, actually. Mm. It's quoted as one of the pillars of the London art world now, along with the opening of Tate Modern. Mm. We look back at the sort of art world and the cultural world in London before those times, and it does seem a little bit, I don't know, it seems like there were more dusty corners before than there are now.
Yeah.
Was the fair, you're obviously taking a punt on that. Mm. Did it have to be successful in its first year for you to be able to do it the second year? Was it advertising money from the magazine that you did it with? How did you, because it's no small undertaking to get people to pay you for each square metre of space.
You're right. It needed to work from the beginning. Yeah. We thought everyone would give us a chance the first time. But if it didn't work, they weren't going to give us a second chance. It's expensive for galleries to participate. And so we knew we had to make it as good as we possibly could. And we tried to reinvent the model a little bit. And, the location in Regent's Park was very popular and we're still in the same location. People liked David Adjaye designed the structure that year and did a fantastic job. We had great food. We commissioned projects by artists that people hadn't really done before. It was about probably two-thirds the size it is now and maybe a third of the number of people, visitors. And there were some, technical glitches, but it was nothing serious enough. And by the end of the fair, people said, well, this is great. We're going to come back. And then all their friends wanted to come as well. So you even could feel the momentum.
And even in that first year, though, you weren't necessarily yourself reduced to walking around with a tool belt on and a spirit level.
I did.
Trying to make sure everyone's booths stood up.
My wife still reminds me that I did bring in my Hoover from home because we didn't have enough Hoovers on site and it was dirty and the carpet wasn't getting clean. And I actually brought my Hoover in.
That's what we want.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about collectors. And I wonder whether you feel that, now that the Frieze Fair has expanded into New York and it's fourth year this year, I guess, there. Whether you think collectors get a bit of a bad rep and the money side of the art world, the commercial side of it, this is the side that you're obviously part of. You put on an art fair, people come, people spend a lot of money to fly around the world to visit your fairs, to buy works at them. Is there any point in defending the wealthy that buy the paintings, or do they do enough work of that with their own ability to travel, to spend, to domicile in the UK and all the rest of it? Mm-hmm. Do your wealthy collectors need defending, or would you rather just
They do, not at all. I'm a huge defender of them. I think they're wonderful people. I mean, there's this lazy cliche for people who don't really know the art world and the art scene of, I don't know, the hedge fund art collector investor who doesn't know anything about art, who's just buying things because they think they're going to go up in value, sells it 6 months later in the auctions, makes a ton of money, the art's rubbish anyway, it's all a big ridiculous game. I mean, for me, that couldn't be further from the truth. The vast majority of art collectors I meet and that come to Frieze and buy are passionately in love with the art that they're buying. They hardly ever sell, if at all. It's the investment, it's not completely devoid from their mind, but it's low down the list. They're looking for art that excites them. For them, it's a kind of lifelong learning journey. It's part of what they do. It's part of their identity. They live with the work. They talk about it. They go to openings. And the wonderful thing about them buying the art is that they're supporting artists, and then artists making some quite radical works. Artists couldn't live without selling their work. They don't get a fee from doing an exhibition at a museum. Teaching's very, very difficult now. There's far fewer jobs and it's less fun than it was teaching. So how are you going to keep going if you're an artist? You're going to try and sell your work, and who's buying it? The collectors. And for them to get a bad rep is, astonishing to me, really.
And, you mentioned the idea, you said this thing, that there's this cliche that's trotted out about ignorant hedge fund managers, A little bit of ignorance is a good thing, though, isn't it? I mean, you want to ask us about liking things. I think Warhol mm-hmm. said that. And mm-hmm. it's not bad to not know much, but to like something.
Well, everyone,
I mean, that presumably is what, when you walk around your fair or a museum show, it's about liking things. I wonder what different complexion it is when you know that stuff is for sale. Mm. I wonder if there's a sense of calm you yourself get from walking around a museum show when you just know that someone else owns it. It's all right.
It's
do you know what I mean? What the gaze is different when it's... Clearly, things don't have price tags on freeze, neither do they have red dots when they're sold. But I wonder how different the pace is. I suppose there's that nice competitive element slightly. But it's a different journey, isn't it, walking around
a
fair and
I mean, like a lot of people who come to freeze are coming to learn more about art. They're professionals or they're artists or they're just interested public. The majority of people are not there to buy something and they're not even thinking about buying something. They're there to see, you know, everything that's going on in art under one roof. And it's a great experience for that. But if you are coming to buy, it adds an extra kind of layer of frisson to it. You know, it's adds a kind of level of excitement because you look at things, you think, huh, I really like that. I really like that, actually. Maybe I could own it. You know, I wonder how much it is. I wonder if it's for sale. And you start that kind of engagement with it. And it just adds another, you know, layer of interest, I think.
Personally, do you have to ration yourself? Are you a bit like a racing tipster that kind of knows what's going to come in first place and, you know, can...
In terms of buying art,
what do you... How do you spread your favours? I mean, this is deeply political, isn't it?
I try and buy something from each of our fairs because it's nice to support them and have a kind of memento. But I like a lot of art. I'm quite
Catholic,
you know,
in
promiscuous,
your taste.
I suppose.
All right. I mean, say Catholic, you say promiscuous. I'm glad it was that way around.
I mean, there's probably, you know, 200 or 300 artists I would love to own a work by. And, you know, and some I'll be able to afford and some I might be able to afford one day. So it just depends on the right thing coming up in the right situation. But yeah, I certainly have to ration myself because I couldn't afford to buy everything I like.
Another one of these things that people talk about is the titanic battle between the galleries and the fairs. And the fairs look after the galleries and the auction houses. Is that an overplayed battle? I mean, presumably you guys are all in a battle for collectors' favours and attentions and cash. Mm. Is that battle sort of overplayed? I mean, the auction world, we think, is quite a homogenous place where you don't find anything new. Mm-hmm. But I wonder whether, you know, people, art market writers... I'm very interested in this, especially at the moment with the auction houses becoming like a kind of very powerful octopus with tentacles all over the world.
Yeah.
Do the fairs have to stick up for the galleries against the auction houses?
They do. I mean, fairs were almost invented as a kind of mass marketing tool for the galleries to be able to market them to the extent that the auction houses do, kind of globally and with a big reach. So we're very much on the side of the galleries and we like the galleries because they're supporting artists. They're working directly with the artists. They've got the very long-term interest of the artists at heart. An artist might be with a gallery for 40 years or 50 years, and works might not get to high value until for 30 years of that relationship, you know. So the galleries are really nurturing these artists, and they're really providing an incredibly supportive role, and we want to support that because that eventually supports artists. Some galleries do secondary market sales, and they would prefer their collectors they work with, if they're reselling something, to come back to the gallery and do it through them, because they can place it with a fantastic museum or other collector and, of course, get some revenue back from that. And they're in competition with the auction houses who are only secondary market for that kind of market. The other big issue that galleries have with the auction houses that has really increased in the last 10 years or so is the sort of age of a work after it's been made to when it comes to auction. It used to be...
This is almost the idea of flipping.
The flipping question, yes, yes.
We call it flipping. It's a family show. Not the other one.
Flipper, yeah.
So this is when people buy works. Maybe they buy it at a gallery or they buy it at Frieze and then they sell it at auction for more.
Quite quickly.
2 months later, maybe, something like that. Yeah,
I mean, maybe not 2 months, but maybe a year later or a couple of years later. And that's seen as a little bit unseemly. You know, it seems like, you didn't really love that work, did you? You weren't really buying it because you wanted it. It was to make a quick profit. And if you're only buying it to make a quick profit, I'd rather sell it to someone who really loves it and who's going to hold on to it and who it's going to mean something to. And if there's any quick profit to be made, you know, better to be made by the artist or the gallery rather than an individual who has no real feel for it. So this is where there's a bit of a battle between the galleries and the auction houses. And I do think it would be wonderful in an ideal world, and it's a bit utopian, if the auction houses had a gentleman's agreement not to sell anything that was less than 5 years old or something like that. I think it would be very good PR for them. I think it would be helpful for artists whose careers are really endangered by being exposed so massively at such an early stage in their careers.
And yeah, if you're a young artist and suddenly the bottom falls out of your market due to purely market forces, but nothing to do with the quality of your work, you're messed up, aren't you?
I mean, you are.
Artists can be delicate creatures, as you know. I mean, it's a tough one to take.
The irony is that you know your bottom can't fall out until your market's gone very high. Mm. So the first step in this process is an artist whose work at the gallery might be £20,000 and suddenly gets an auction result of £200,000. And most people, laymen, would think, that's a great thing for the artist. Lucky them. They're worth now valuable. You know, they can sell all their work for that much. They're going to be rich. Well, actually, that's not necessarily what happens, because the gallery doesn't, they want to put the price up, but gradually, so it's sustainable. Everyone who owns one of those works who bought it for £20,000 now sees, I could make £200,000. That's quite difficult to resist, even for the greatest collectors. A lot comes onto the market. The artist gets branded as a sort of market darling. Curators stop putting them in shows because they think, oh, it's all hype. Suddenly there's an auction result that was less than the £200,000, and no one's interested, not even the collectors or the curators. And it might be a decent artist who could have had a long career. So it's an issue.
We've kind of zoomed quite a gallop through Frieze. As we said, it's grown from London to New York. It's a locomotive that hopefully won't stop. Mm-hmm. You've jumped out of the saddle, you and Amanda. Mm-hmm. Victoria Siddle's your new director. What might be next? You don't have to give us an exclusive, but we'd love it if you did.
Well, you wouldn't be doing a job if you didn't ask, would you, Rob? Yeah, I mean, we're going through a research process now. And I try and temper people's expectations and say, look, it was 12 years after we did the magazine doing the fair. It was another 10 years until we did Frieze New York and Frieze Masters after doing the fair. We like to think things through properly and release them when they're properly ready and make them work. So we don't sort of jump into things that we just try it for a few months and then can it if it's not working. So the last time we looked there, we had a list of about 18 ideas. We're narrowing them down, but maybe one will come to fruition in the next 2 or 3 years. So I can't tell you what it is, only because I don't know yet. The lovely thing about what we do at the moment is that there's a cultural angle to it and there's a commercial angle to it. And that's difficult to find. You know, you can find a lot of things that are very cultural but super non-commercial. In fact, are money-losing situations or philanthropic situations. And you can find things that are very commercial but have very little cultural aspect. And those are kind of less interesting as well. So, you know, trying to find a way of combining these things, maybe one subsidising the other, although we've never really done that, and thinking about the kind of, you know, commercial or organisational structures you need for the different things, how they relate to what we're doing at the moment. It's a lot of fun. We're really enjoying it.
Well, we've zoomed from 1991, the foundation of Frieze magazine, to 2003 and the foundation of the Frieze Fair. We've run over a lot of hurdles as well. It's been fascinating talking to you. Matthew Slotover, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was fun.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Robert Bound, talking to Frieze co-founder Matthew Slotover. Next week, Andrew Tuck meets the award-winning novelist Alan Hollinghurst. Goodbye, and thanks for tuning in.